Evolutionary Psychology, Part 1, The Science of Human Nature, Lecture 5, Deconstructing the Blank Slate.
In the previous lecture, we considered the idea that the human mind consists of a set of evolved psychological mechanisms, which are sometimes called modules. I explained that evolved psychological mechanisms are evolutionary adaptations that exist in the human mind today, because in the past they had the effect of increasing the relative survival and reproduction of the individuals that had them. I also pointed out the similarities between evolved psychological mechanisms and fixed action patterns, as first described and analyzed by Konrad Lorenz and the other founders of the science of ethology. Like fixed action patterns, evolved psychological mechanisms are produced by sensory, nervous, and motor systems that produce adaptive behaviors. Also, like fixed action patterns, evolved psychological mechanisms have both innate and learned components. The main difference is that evolved psychological mechanisms generally consist of the innate capacity to learn particular kinds of behaviors at particular times and in particular ways, whereas most fixed action patterns are largely innate, reflex-like behaviors, only partially modifiable via experience. At the end of the previous lecture, I suggested that many people would find these ideas very different from what they understood about the origin and development of the human mind. This is because most people today are either innatists or social constructivists. Innatists, and this is most European psychologists until recently, believe in a model of the human mind that is similar to what many people mistakenly think is the central concept of evolutionary psychology, that most or all significant human behaviors and their underlying motivations are almost entirely innate and not very amenable to change as a result of experience or learning. By contrast, social constructivists believe in a model of the human mind that is very similar to that promoted by the American behaviorists of the 20th century, that most or all of significant human behaviors are almost entirely learned and therefore infinitely malleable as the result of experience. In other words, innatists and social constructivists come down on opposite sides of the nature-nurture debate. Innatists believe in an almost entirely innate human nature, whereas social constructivists believe in an almost entirely learned human nature, with no innate tendencies to learn particular behaviors. Innatism is a very old tradition, common to many cultures, but most exemplified by the philosophy of Plato. According to this philosophy, humans are born with an innate knowledge of particular ideas, such as good and bad, right and wrong, and the existence of God or supernatural entities. Innatists also believe that people are born with particular talents and proclivities, such as a talent for mathematics or music or a tendency towards criminal behavior, which will eventually be expressed despite social influences to the contrary. Social constructivists, on the other hand, believe in a model of the human mind that is similar to the one described by the behaviorist John B. Watson in 1930, who said, "Give me a dozen healthy infants, well-formed, and my own specified world to bring them up in, and I'll guarantee to take anyone at random and train him to become any type of specialist I might select. Doctor, lawyer, artist, merchant chief, and yes, even beggar man and thief, regardless of his talents, pensions, tendencies, abilities, vocations, and the race of his ancestors." Social constructivism, by contrast with innatism, is a relatively new tradition, limited primarily to the United States, and reaching its apogee in the work of B.F. Skinner. According to this viewpoint, humans have no innate ideas, nor any tendency to learn particular behaviors in particular ways and at particular times. Rather, human behavior is infinitely plastic and is almost entirely molded by experience within particular social contexts. Change the context and you change the mind, and therefore you change the person. Ethologists, that is, scientists who study animal behavior from an evolutionary viewpoint, generally don't even participate in the nature-nurture debate. The model of animal behavior used by most ethologists is based on the assumption that almost all significant behaviors involve a blend of innate and learned components. This is even true of fixed action patterns, which ethologist Nico Tinbergen implied in his first question about ethology. That is, that almost always behaviors can be modified as a result of learning, especially during development. Again, evolutionary psychology is based on the assumption that most significant human behaviors are the product of evolved psychological mechanisms, which are evolved tendencies to learn particular behaviors in particular contexts, at particular times, and in particular ways. Why does this idea sound peculiar, even threatening to some people, especially social scientists? And, more importantly, why does this idea generate so much controversy in the public sphere? The reason is essentially historical. Beginning in the middle of the 19th century, the dominant social theory about human behavior and motivation was what has since become known as social Darwinism. Despite its name, social Darwinism owes few of its main ideas to the work of Charles Darwin. Rather, social Darwinism is most closely associated with the social theories of English political scientist, philosopher, and sociologist Herbert Spencer. Herbert Spencer was a contemporary and a friend of Charles Darwin. Born in 1820 in Derby in the south of England, Spencer was widely recognized as the preeminent English social philosopher of the 19th century. At that time, his books were more famous in many circles than Darwin's, and he was widely quoted and cited as an authority on an extraordinarily wide range of topics. His most famous book, Social Statics, first published in 1851, outsold Darwin's Origin of Species and is often cited as the first book on sociology to reach the mass market. Indeed, so popular and influential was Social Statics that in a landmark Supreme Court case in 1905, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes felt obliged to write in his dissent that the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution does not enact Mr. Herbert Spencer's Social Statics. Spencer published his most famous books at about the same time that Darwin published The Origin of Species, The Descent of Man, and The Expression of the Emotions in Men and Animals. Spencer proposed a theory of evolution that paralleled Darwin's in some respects, but which he applied much more widely than Darwin did. Central to Spencer's philosophy was the idea that evolution is progressive. It begins with primitive, unorganized matter, which then steadily climbs into more complex and more perfectly formed systems, from atoms to cells, from cells to animals, and ultimately to humans and human societies. This idea has been called evolutionism, and actually predates Darwin's theories by at least a century. Lamarck's theory of evolution by means of the inheritance of acquired characteristics, published almost half a century before Darwin's Origin of Species, was another of the central works of evolutionism. Like Spencer's, Lamarck's theory was relentlessly progressive, assuming that all living organisms evolved into more complex forms in a steady drive towards greater and greater perfection, once again reaching its culmination in the evolution of humans. Spencer proposed essentially the same idea, but proposed a different mechanism by which progressive evolution occurred. Spencer called this mechanism survival of the fittest, a phrase that Alfred Russel Wallace recommended to Darwin as a replacement for natural selection. Darwin eventually adopted it, using it interchangeably with natural selection, in the sixth and final edition of his Origin of Species. Ironically, Darwin adopted Spencer's term because it avoided the purposeful connotations of selection, and his term, natural selection. Having been born into the middle class, Spencer intended his theories to counter what he considered to be the socially regressive idea that society should be based on the natural superiority of the aristocracy. Spencer was a liberal and believed that merit should depend on individual accomplishments rather than on inherited social class, which was the predominant belief in England up until the 19th century. It is therefore ironic that one of the main ideas underlying Spencer's evolutionism has come to epitomize a regressive social policy that tends to justify the excesses of laissez-faire capitalism. This idea, which is central to social Darwinism, is the idea that laissez-faire capitalism naturally produces the survival of the fittest, and that therefore those who rise to the top of the economic and social ladder deserve the privileges that their accomplishments have afforded them. Furthermore, Spencer asserted that this process produces the most ideal society possible, and that therefore any attempt to limit the operation of laissez-faire capitalism was socially regressive and opposed to the natural progress of evolution. In essence, social Darwinism is a theory of social ethics that is supposedly derived directly from scientific principles. Since survival of the fittest naturally produces the best and the brightest, allowing natural selection to take its course is both good and right. In sum, therefore, social Darwinism is the doctrine that survival of the fittest produces superior people in more perfect societies, and therefore is not only natural, it's right and should therefore be encouraged. During the second half of the 19th century, social Darwinism was associated with the unparalleled increase in material prosperity that resulted from the Industrial Revolution. Many of the captains of industry, people like Andrew Carnegie and Henry Ford, strongly supported the idea of social Darwinism and the closely applied science, so-called, of eugenics. Both Darwin and his strongest and best-known supporter, Thomas Henry Huxley, praised Spencer and his application of evolutionary ideas to the betterment of society. Following the rediscovery of Mendelian genetics in 1900, Gregor Mendel's ideas were applied to the genetic improvement of the human species in the new science of eugenics, and once again, prominent evolutionary theorists, most notably R.A. Fisher and J.B.S. Haldane, were among its staunchest supporters. However, both social Darwinism and eugenics were adopted by the leaders of Nazi Germany in the 1930s and used to justify their policies of military expansion, totalitarianism, and negative eugenics, which culminated in World War II and the Holocaust. Following World War II, social scientists, especially in America, decisively rejected social Darwinism and eugenics, and many of them extended their criticism of evolutionary ideas to evolutionary biology itself. This criticism was most intense among Marxists, whose theories of economics and social development were also ironically part of the overall theory of progressive evolutionism. In the social sciences, the idea is that there is no inherent human nature and that all human behaviors are purely learned, are most closely identified with the disciplines of anthropology, behaviorism, social psychology, and sociology. In these fields, the standard social science model and the concept of the human mind as a blank slate played a central role both in the founding of these sciences and their development during the 20th century. The rise of behaviorism in the United States paralleled and reinforced the ascendancy of the standard social science model, as it was based on essentially the same idea, that human behavior had no innate influences of any kind, and was therefore essentially infinitely modifiable. This idea also reinforced the rise of liberal economics and politics in the United States during the same period. Furthermore, since human behavior was assumed to be infinitely plastic and entirely formed by experience, that is, learning, there were no predictable patterns in human behavior, beyond what could be predicted as a result of learning and social influences. The founders of the science of anthropology, Franz Boas, Alfred Kroeber, Claude Lévi-Strauss, Margaret Mead, and Ruth Benedict, argued strongly for the social constructivist model of the human mind and human behavior. They asserted that all human behavior and motivations arise out of human cultural interactions. Therefore, like the behaviorists, they asserted that humans and human behavior was infinitely malleable. Change the culture, and you change the human, and you change the human mind. Sociology, too, and the closely allied field of social psychology were based on essentially the same premise and for essentially the same reasons. Although the reasons were usually couched in scientific terms, they were more political and social than scientific. As B.F. Skinner advocated in Beyond Freedom and Dignity, they all asserted that the route to human perfectibility was clear, and that modification of the human environment would lead directly to a new and better society. And as their reaction to the rise of the science of sociobiology so clearly indicated, they all believed that any attempt to include evolutionary ideas in the explanation of human social behavior was pernicious, unlikely to result in misery on a global scale. This is why the first challenges to the standard social science model generated so much vehement opposition, with its challengers being accused of advocating social Darwinism, eugenics, racism, sexism, and even providing a natural justification for totalitarianism and genocide. One exception among the social sciences to this wholesale adoption of the standard social science model and rejection of any evolutionary premises was economics. Unlike anthropology, behaviorism, social psychology, and sociology, economics and economic theory is founded on an essentially evolutionary premise. That premise is that humans, and indeed all economic agents, act in such a way as to maximize their own self-interest. Virtually all economic theories, except perhaps Marxism, are based on this premise. But the paradox of economics is that by pursuing only their personal self-interests, humans act, in the words of Adam Smith, as if guided by an invisible hand to promote the general welfare. Hence, the theories of human behavior based on evolutionary biology, such as those proposed by Robert Trivers and George Price, have been adopted and expanded by economists much more easily than in the other social scientists. Another exception was linguistics, in which the work of Noam Chomsky is perhaps best known. Chomsky argued that the acquisition of human language is essentially innate, based on observations of the deep grammar of all known human languages. Later work by Eric Lenneberg and others strongly suggested that human language acquisition is essentially a form of imprinting, a behavior first described by ethologist and Nobel Prize winner Konrad Lorenz. Like imprinting, human language acquisition occurs during a well-defined critical period. If language is not acquired during this critical period, it cannot be acquired at a later age. Once acquired, the ability to speak and understand spoken language is never forgotten or lost, except as the result of brain damage, although the specific language one learns may change over time. Unlike conditioned behaviors, reinforcement is not necessary for language acquisition. Indeed, negative reinforcement does not stop it. Specific brain regions are wired for language. Damage to such areas can cause the complete loss of the ability to speak or to understand spoken language. Finally, although the capacity to acquire and use spoken language is clearly innate, the actual language one learns during the critical period depends entirely on what language you learn during that time. In other words, we inherit the capacity to learn language. Perhaps no one has generated more controversy and been accused of more vile intentions than E.O. Wilson, both for his book Sociobiology, The New Synthesis, and for his follow-up book On Human Nature. Wilson provided the groundwork upon which the theories of evolutionary psychology have been developed. In On Human Nature, Wilson argued that humans have several evolved behavioral tendencies, including the ability to acquire and use language, personal and social aggression, including a tendency towards warfare, the establishment and maintenance of dominance hierarchies, role differentiation on the basis of gender, mating systems that include considerable non-reproductive sexual behavior, altruistic behavior and social cooperation, and a tendency towards religious behavior and belief. Wilson's discussion of most of these tendencies was closer to natural history than scientific analysis, in that he mostly describes observable tendencies rather than providing detailed explanation for those tendencies based on various theoretical models of selection. Wilson mentioned, but did not rigorously apply, theories of kin selection and reciprocal altruism in the context of the evolution of the tendencies towards various behaviors described. Wilson also did not directly attack the standard social science model, concentrating instead on presenting an alternative explanation for the origin and evolution of human behavioral tendencies and mental abilities. He was also careful to point out the same caveat that ethologists point out when explaining animal behavior, that all behaviors are the result of a blend of innate and learned components, and therefore are not immune to change as a result of changes in the environment, nor immune to historical influences, that is, in our development of individuals or in our evolutionary histories. More recently, Steven Pinker has mounted a direct frontal assault on the standard social science model in his book, The Blank Slate, published in 2002. In it, he ties the blank slate concept at the heart of the standard social science model to two other ideas, the noble savage and the ghost in the machine. The idea behind the noble savage, most closely associated with French philosopher and writer Rousseau, is that humans are born as essentially innocent beings with no tendencies towards any antisocial behaviors and are later corrupted through contact with society. The implication of this idea is that all that should be necessary to change human nature is to change society, so that it replaces the state of nature enjoyed by the noble savage. Paradoxically, the very same noble savages cited by Rousseau and others as the natural state of humankind were cited by Darwin as being barely above the level of apes in dignity, intelligence, and social respectability. The idea behind the ghost in the machine is that humans have a soul, which is not reducible to our evolved biological nature. Paradoxically, this idea is derived from the innatist philosophy of Plato. But unlike his philosophy, the modern ghost in the machine has no essential nature beyond free will. In other words, all we have in our mind, which somehow lives in our nervous system someplace, is a self that can choose completely freely between different alternative behaviors. Central to this idea is such a choice can be made completely independently from any innate or learned influences. That's why it's called free will. Pinker systematically disposes of these three assumptions underlying the standard social science model, using arguments derived primarily from cognitive psychology and artificial intelligence, linguistics, and evolutionary psychology. Pinker's argument from cognitive psychology is based on the observation that the algorithms developed by cognitive psychologists and computer programmers can do precisely what both the innatists and the social constructivists said couldn't be done, but for different reasons. That is, they can generate behavior and motivations and even thoughts from living neurons or electrical circuits. Pinker states it like this: the mental world can be grounded in the physical world by the concepts of information, computation, and feedback. Facial recognition, weather prediction, even winning games of chess against grandmasters can now be programmed into computers using these principles, Since computers are composed of purely physical materials, programmed by purely mental concepts, there's no reason to think that the human nervous system and mind cannot work the same way. Furthermore, Pinker points out that a blank slate can't do anything by itself. Just like a computer, the human mind requires a program, that is, a set of decision rules by which it can link inputs to outputs. Where does this set of decision rules come from? According to evolutionary psychologists, they evolved by means of natural selection in our evolutionary past. Using an argument derived from Chomsky's theory of universal grammar, Pinker also points out that an infinite range of behavior can be generated by finite combinatorial programs in the mind. Just as an infinite number of English sentences can be composed to express the full range of human experience, an infinite number of human behaviors and thoughts can be composed using a relatively small set of simple combination rules that define the logic that governs their generation. What are these finite combinatorial programs in the mind? Well, they're the evolved psychological mechanisms that evolutionary psychologists propose as the fundamental operating units of the human mind. This, in turn, implies that universal mental mechanisms underlie superficial variation between cultures. Just as a deep grammar underlies the immense variation between human languages, a deep logic underlies the immense variation between human cultural practices. This explains why, although there are amazing differences between human cultural practices, there are also startling similarities. This also explains why, although human behavior is extremely adaptable, it is not infinitely adaptable. Human behavior is only a small subset of the overwhelming behavioral diversity found in the kingdom Animalia. Out of the foregoing, Pinker then distills a final principle. The mind is a complex system composed of many interacting parts. Once again, this is simply a restatement of the massive modularity hypothesis upon which evolutionary psychology is based. Rather than having to learn absolutely everything from scratch via trial and error and conditioning, we apply an inherited set of decision rules, call them evolutionary rules of thumb, which make it possible to react quickly and effectively to a rapidly changing culture and natural environment. The massive modularity hypothesis that Pinker's analysis supports also parallels what we now know about the structure of the brain and how it influences the mind. A half century of brain studies have shown that the brain is not a single-purpose machine supporting the actions of a single-minded person. Rather, the brain is a loose confederacy of semi-independent modules, most of them specialized to perform fairly specific tasks. One of these modules, which consists of bundles of neurons in the brain, produces the sensation that we think of as our self. But, far from being the author of our actions, this self is mostly an observer of the outcomes of the activity of the other modules that make up the confederacy that we think of as ourself. Furthermore, neither the tasks nor the programs that function to produce them are necessarily all working towards the same coordinated end. Extensive research into patients with split brains and volunteers with modules suppressed by localized drug infusions have shown that modules can think for themselves and even produce conflicting actions in the same self. These findings strongly support the massive modularity hypothesis that forms the basis for much of evolutionary psychology. They also explain why we often feel of two minds about our actions and their motivations, and may find ourselves doing things that we don't really want to do, but can't seem to stop ourselves from doing, such as smoking, or shouting at our kids, or driving too fast, or shirking our responsibilities for a little more time in Second Life, or World of Warcraft, or Facebook. Once again, the processing modules that make up our brains, like the evolved psychological mechanisms that make up our minds, are supposed to make us happy, nor more contented, nor better people. Indeed, they aren't supposed to do anything. They exist because, in the past, those individuals that had them survived and reproduced more often than those that didn't. And they do so because of that simple fact. It's a very long way from the blank slate of the standard social science model to the confederacy of specialists that make up the mind described by evolutionary psychology. Now that we've seen how the mind is constructed, it's time to view some of its contents. In other words, it's time to get down to the nitty-gritty of how our confederacy works and what it predisposes us to do and not do. In the next lecture, we will examine the most basic of human needs, food, clothing, shelter, and health, and see what evolutionary psychology says about them. One thing's for sure, it'll provide plenty of food for thought.
This ends Lecture 5.